What I want to talk to you a little bit about, I mean, obviously Puppet, but more the state of operations management, change management, all of that system administrative stuff when you have more than one machine. You're on record as saying that a lot of the tools for monitoring are pretty good, but a lot of the tools that we have for managing instances of machines or managing large banks of machines, server farms, desktop farms, whatever, are still stuck in a 20-year-old mentality.
Yep.
How does that work?
Very poorly. If you look at the way most people think about management, they take an SSH and a for loop kind of mentality. And the few tools that don't do that, so CFEngine is probably the best example of a tool that most people seem to know about now. A lot of people either start using it or they look at it and decide that it isn't worth the headache. But CFEngine does some to alleviate the SSH in a for loop problem in that it allows you to kind of describe what you want your machines to look like. But at the same time, it's really, really low level. So if you'd like to, say, provision a given service across multiple machines, multiple platforms, which is a really common problem, CFEngine forces you to essentially consider that same service to be a completely different service because you have to deal with all these details, all these, you know, where is the file located and what is the actual service name. There's no ability to say, I want to step up a level and ignore those details and really focus on the service itself.
For example, I want SSH services running on all my machines, whether it's a FreeBSD server, a Mac OS X desktop, a Linux device, whatever.
Right. So SSH is a great example. Everyone runs SSH. It's produced by this. It's always the same application. It's always the same service. It's always the same configuration files. But if you look at file locations, on OS X, they're in etc. On FreeBSD, they're in user local etc. And on most Linuxes, they're in etc SSH. You look at the service name, sometimes it's SSH, sometimes it's SSHD, sometimes it's OpenSSH, sometimes it's OpenSSHD. So you want to be able to say, I'd like to talk about the SSH service, and most tools say, I don't know what you mean, all I've got is OpenSSH, except, of course, they aren't that helpful. They just say, I don't know what you mean, and then they exit.
So in terms of what we're looking at, the existing state of system administration, when you're calling this a 20-year-old feature, the thinking is, I have a whole lot of shell scripts that know how to execute files, and
right.
I have to hard code my paths to my configuration files. If I make a change, I have to SCP or rsync all of these configuration files to the right bank of machines. And the resource concept in Puppet lets you step back and say, run SSH. Platform-specific details will take care of that. Elsewhere, you say, I want SSH running, and I want it to look like this.
Yep. And the whole configuration files, like, this is one of the, kind of everyone tends to think of configuration files. And the problem there is that the majority of your configuration files across your machines are actually the same. I mean, you know, look at etc/password as an example of, people don't think of etc/password as a configuration file anymore, but, you know, clearly it is. 90% of the users in that file, in most cases, are the same users. They're all the system users. And so we have these good tools to manage the rest of those configuration files, the rest of the files, the bits that are different for us. But for most of the configuration files, we don't have those tools. So we're forced to write our own tools to manage the differences and the similarities. So you look at how people distribute config files, and what they'll do is they'll have 78 versions of a given file. This one goes to this host, so this one goes to this class of hosts, so this one goes to, you know, all the hosts in this data center or something like that. And for one, you have this huge duplication, right, because you've got a lot of similarity among all those files. But the more nefarious problem there is that you can look at the configuration that says this host gets this file, and what you don't know is what's actually going on.
You don't know why that host gets that file.
Well, so there's the why, but there's also, like, what's actually different between this host's file and the default file.
Right.
So there's you're right that you're missing the intent, but you're also missing the information itself.
You're missing.
All you know is that this host has a different configuration file.
Right.
And in fact, most people, what they do is they say, here's the list of files that a host could receive, and it'll be this ordered list that says, look for a host-specific file, and then a class-specific file, and then an operating system-specific file, and then the default file. And in that situation, you literally, looking at the configuration, you have no idea if a file even exists for this host, much less what's going to be in that file.
Right, right.
So it's completely non-deterministic. It's horrendous. Or it's deterministic, it's just you can't, from a given place, you can never figure out what's going to happen. You have to look in three different configuration locations to determine what's going to happen. And even then, you have to diff, you know, once you say, there is a host-specific file, you have to diff that to all the other files to see what's different about this host versus other hosts.
And this is a direct consequence of being stuck in the everything system administration is a shell script or a configuration file, and all we can do is work with these specific files as they are. It's a
exactly.
result of that mentality.
Right. And then, of course, you can throw someone like NetInfo into the mix. Say you've got all these great file tools, and somebody says, I've got a Mac, and I want you to manage some users, and you're like, those aren't files. I'm
That's stuck, right.
You know? Or LDAP, or anything like that. Like, I've got APIs instead of files. I don't know what to do.
We can make the argument, of course, that the Unix file structure is, in fact, an API. But I take your point. That's a very good point. When did you have the realization that managing or modeling these behaviors and these services and these configurations as resources in Puppet was the right way to go? Was it something you'd always sort of known all along? Was it something you picked up from CF Engine, or did it sort of gradually come up?
So about 5 or 6 years ago, I had rewritten a tool called ISConf by a guy named Steve Trogut. He wrote a seminal paper in, I believe, 99 for Lisa that kind of went through, you know, if you're going to have a managed infrastructure, you've heard the kind of the 9 core services that your infrastructure needs to provide in order to make all the rest of your services work. He did some work at Morgan Stanley and other places with what he called ISConf, which is a very simple make-based tool.
Mm-hmm.
His idea was to store all the work you didn't make and then execute these make targets in a specific order, and thus you could always recreate the systems. So this was my first interaction, my first exposure to somebody else's tool to do this kind of work. So I experimented with his tool, decided that what he had, which was kind of a typical combination of make, Perl, and shell, was just not quite sufficient. And so I rewrote the whole thing in a couple thousand lines of Perl. But quickly found, so all the work was being done in make. And so you got a package to install, and you go, okay, I want to install this package. You make a make target for that. And you're like, I might want to install another package. And the make target looks almost exactly the same except for the name of the package.
Right.
So I started abstracting out what it meant to install a package, and I'd create these kind of default make targets. So it'd be like package /%, and using at least gmake, you could do these kind of special magical, what are they called, like stanza matching things. So you could extract the replacement parameter for %, and have your package stanza know what package to install based on how the stanza was called.
Right.
So one place you'd say, I want package /OpenSSH, and another place you'd have a package /% stanza that knew how to extract the OpenSSH from the stanza name.
Mm-hmm.
So this was the start of that, in that it was an accidental, because make wasn't very powerful. The way to communicate information into make and the way to abstract things in make was really simplistic. But what I found was pretty quickly I had stanzas for all the major things I needed to manage. I could have, you know, I had package stanzas and resource stanzas, or cron stanzas and host stanzas. And they knew how to do all this stuff. The problem with this, though, is that packages are easy. They're usually either installed or not installed.
Right.
Things like cron jobs or hosts are harder because they have multiple attributes. You can't, you know, you don't want to try to extract all the fields from a cron job from the make stanza name. That's just not pleasant.
Right.
I mean, already doing this kind of stuff in make stanzas is already unpleasant. So what I started doing then was building, in one place I'd build a table of all the resources I had. Here's a data dumped hash of all of the cron jobs that I'm ever going to install anywhere in my infrastructure. And then what my make stanzas would do would just say, well, I want that named cron. You know, I'd name each of the cron jobs. And then I could extract one of the cron jobs and say, I want that one installed, or I want that one removed. And so I had this kind of symbolic representation of a resource. You know, I wasn't using the term resource back then, but of a resource. And then in another place I'd say, and this host gets that resource.
So were you able to write out instructions to the make file, make install SSH or make package open SSH? Were you able to describe in code or maybe a little shell script or configuration file exactly what to install and configure when you set up a new host?
Right. So ISConf was kind of weird in that what you did with a host was you said, here are the N number of make stanzas it takes to turn you into what you're supposed to be.
Right.
So if you're an Apache host, then there are, you know, 25 make stanzas associated with being an Apache host. And then there are timestamps associated with each of those make stanzas, and they all get run in the correct order every time. And so, you know, they'll kind of do each thing in turn. It was a really clumsy system, and I wrote this paper in, I believe, 01, no, it was 02, I think, that basically said ISConf wasn't quite sufficient because Make is a horrible API. So what I did was I integrated ISConf with CF Engine, and initially it was kind of, most of the work was still on ISConf, but what I found is that all of these modules I'd written that allowed me to manage packages and cron jobs and hosts as resources translated really well to CF Engine, and CF Engine has a similarly crappy API, essentially.
Right.
If you want to integrate CF Engine with an external tool, your only real integration point is what amounts to a shell script.
Mm-hmm.
So with CF Engine, I had this similar kind of thing where I'd have this database of resources, and I'd collect what all the resources were and how they were configured outside of CF Engine, and then I would use CF Engine to make decisions about what resources I wanted. So, you know, if I'm in this class, then add these five hosts, or these five cron jobs to the host. If I'm in that class, add these five packages to the host. And so I had this, I realized after a couple of years of doing CF Engine and doing consulting that I had this split. All my decisions were in CF Engine, but all my actual work was in another application entirely. And there wasn't really much consistency to that application because, you know, I do cron jobs one way and I do packages another way.
Right.
So when I realized I wanted to fix that, what I really wanted to do was teach CF Engine how to understand abstract resource types. I want to add a cron resource type to CF Engine. I want to add, you know, a service resource type or, you know, any of those things. And then you look at the CF Engine code and you realize that it's 60,000 lines of spaghetti C code and that, you know, there are 25 unique syntaxes in the language and things like that. So,
and there's one maintainer who is, I don't want to say, you know, really strict about holding on to control of it, but you have the one maintainer and he keeps pretty tight watch over it.
He does, and he, I think the biggest problem with him was that, well, for one, he had this, there was this great quote from him around probably 2005 that where he said that he thought version control was overhead.
Right.
And of course, he's a CS professor, right? So he would know.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of frightening, and that you're like, you know, look, let's collaborate on this. And he's like, you know, that stuff's all unnecessary, even though we're getting bug regressions and things like that. But then you also had issues where he would say, this is how it should be. He had these, I mean, anybody who starts writing C especially, but kind of most languages, starts with gigantic case statements scattered throughout the whole system.
Right, right.
But anybody who does very much for very long learns, you know, that doesn't scale well, that doesn't work well.
You need that,
and it certainly
extract,
very expensive.
Refactor conditional to polymorphism,
exactly.
Pattern.
Yeah, and he thought that that was the stupidest thing he'd ever heard. So what that meant was if you wanted to add a new resource type to CF Engine, and CF Engine calls them actions,
mm-hmm.
then you had to find every one of these case statements and add support for your action in that case statement throughout the whole system, which meant, of course, there's no way you could ever write, you know, a redistributable module that could just be dynamically loaded by CF Engine.
No, you're writing a patch against the whole thing.
Right. And so that when you look at that and you go, well, yes, I could refactor all of CF Engine to make this work, or I could pick a language that I'm more fluent in, you know, I'm just going to be more productive in general because it's a much higher language,
mm-hmm.
higher level language than C. So that's when I started experimenting with a separate tool. And with Puppet, I kind of, the core things that I came in with were I wanted to have this core idea of a resource. I wanted resources to be, I wanted anybody to be able to add a new resource type. It couldn't just be up to me what resource types existed. And of course, I had to extract, I wanted to really separate the language, the way of talking about resources, from the library that defines them so that you could add a new resource type and not have to modify the parser. I mean, which seems obvious, but in the CF Engine world, every action needed direct support in the parser.
And the same thing with your Make system as well.
Excuse me?
And I imagine the same thing with your Make-based solution earlier as well.
Yeah. You had to go in and modify Make, and you had to add your code, and you had to kind of all three places need to be updated at once.
And you worry about shell script quoting and all sorts of other rules there.
Yeah. Shell script quoting is awesome.
Yeah. Try writing cross-platform Make. You can't rely on always having gmake available.
No, in fact, I had this really fun, I mean, I was running this on, at the time, I think it was Solaris and HPUX, and that's probably all. I was doing, I mean, it was pleasant enough, and so I was doing basically a bootstrap where the first make stanza installed gmake, and then the next make stanza just exited if gmake wasn't in use.
Exactly.
And then you had to have this nasty bootstrap phrase. And that was definitely one of my goals going into Puppet, was like, let's make Bootstrap really simple. If you've got Puppet installed, you shouldn't need to do anything else. You know, there's authentication aspects, so you've got to go through this key signing process. But even key signing in Puppet is really, really simple. And, you know, the story, if you heard the Red Monk podcast with myself and Nigel Kirsten from Google last week, he's talking about being at an Apple conference and listening to Jeff McCune talk about Puppet and how awesome it is. And so during the course of the Jeff's actual talk, Nigel, you know, VPNs into Google, takes one of the virtual machines, sets up Puppet on it, and is managing sudo by the end of the call,
right,
by the end of the talk. And it's like, you know, that's what you want.
Exactly.
There's a competitor to Puppet called BCFG by someone else in the Unix community, by Narayan Desai. And he likes to say that it's very reasonable to get a bconfig installation up and running in as little as 3 days. And I'm like, 3 days?
3 days is pretty good. It's an improvement anyway. We'll call it that.
Yeah. So the resources were a big part of what led me to discard the existing tools. And I looked at a lot of other tools out there. You've got LCFG, which is probably the oldest and most mature tool in use at the University of Edinburgh. And it's got some really great features, but it also has, it's just a bunch of shell scripts still. It's a bunch of whatever scripts you want in the end. You've got Smart Frog out of HP, which is, again, really interesting. It's got a great language, but there's no resources. There's no higher-level abilities at all. CERN has this tool called Quator that was dead for a while, but apparently it's been resurrected recently by somebody. Now that the Large Hadron Collider is actually producing data, I guess they needed to worry about it again.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of has the same thing. So I went to all these tools in turn and went, I want abstraction. And they went, we've got great facilities for something or other. I'm like, well, that's not really sufficient.
I'm sure any large organization or company has some sort of homegrown, if not multiple homegrown solutions to this.
Yeah, that's why 90% competition is what people wrote internally.
Right.
Fortunately, most people don't like what they have. You talk to most sysadmins and you go, so what are you using? They go, oh, God, I got this just junky thing that I wrote myself, and oh, I'm embarrassed. I could never publish it because it's such horrible code. So if you can come to them and say, well, I've got this great tool that everyone loves.
And in just 3 days, you can be up and running.
Yeah, or in just an hour.
Exactly.
then people seem to be a lot more interested in that. And everyone's really concerned that sysadmins are going to have so much ego attached to their own implementations. But the truth is that sysadmins are pragmatists in almost all cases. That, you know, their goal is to, can I go home earlier? Is there some way I can get more done in less time? You know, they're not going to publish their code anyway. And Puppet is actually, it's a good enough tool. It makes it easy enough to write readable, simple code that people are more likely to publish Puppet code than they are their own tools.
And I understand you're working on a repository of resources and models that people can reuse and redistribute. Is that right?
Yes, it is. That's one of our goals for the year, is to get a, you know, the most recognizable, especially for you, is, you know, a CPAN of Puppet modules.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, most people's problems aren't unique. Everyone has some unique problems, but for a given person's problems, most of those problems are shared by a large number of other people. So if you can download solutions to those problems rather than having to figure it out yourself every time, or not even figure it out, it's easy, right? It's not like, it doesn't take intellectual effort.
Right.
It just takes you typing out the stupid code, debugging it, make sure it all works across all your platforms, and then you hopefully never think about it again.
Right.
So our goal is to make it so you can download those things. And we're going to experiment with whether, you know, sometimes it's going to make sense to allow people to sell solutions on there versus just download them. You know, I don't know about that kind of stuff, but it'll be an interesting experiment anyway.
Certainly. Now, I imagine that probably at this point people are reading or listening to this and thinking, now, wait a second, I can just make an image of an installed server, or I can just have a virtual machine and clone that. Why do I need this configuration management to help me set up things? And I suspect I know what you're going to say, but can you respond to that?
Yeah, this comes up a lot in the cloud thing. People say, you know, well, I don't need Puppet in the cloud because I've got virtual machines and I can just clone as many virtual machines as I want. And there are a couple that can work, but if you look at, say, your kind of standard LAMP stack, what you're going to have is, at the very minimum, you're going to have a load director in front. You're going to have a web server, an application server, a database server.
Mm-hmm.
So, and this is assuming a single application. So now you've got four different images that you need to maintain. And anytime you want a new one, you update that image. You bring up a new version of that image. But if you ever want to change that image, let's say, you know, bring out a new version of Apache, or you add a new user to your system, how do you add that user to your system? Well, you modify your image, you upload the new image to EC2 or whatever, and then you reboot all the machines on your network to get that new user.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, what if you want to add a user to all four of your images? Now you're opening up all four of your images, adding that new user, and then rebooting your whole network just to get a new user.
But I can just do this with
awesome.
A for loop over a shell script. Or a statement,
right, exactly.
Right?
Now you're back to square one.
Exactly.
So the truth is that images make a lot of things a lot easier. But when it all comes down to it, VMware is great for managing the outside of a box. I've been told this is a horrible analogy, but the way that I think about it is all these virtual machine systems, they're really good at managing, at producing and managing eggs. These self-contained, sealed eggs of functionality, but they are not very good about getting into the system. They can't get inside that egg and manage what's going on there. So you need a tool like Puppet to get inside the machine to say, all right, now that I'm up and I'm running, let's differentiate this host. So you look at most organizations, what they do is they'll use something like Kickstart or Jumpstart or Ignite to get the machine from bare metal to a functional OS, but as little as possible, kind of a stem cell operating system that is completely undifferentiated. And then they'll, part of that installation gets Puppet on there, and then from there, Puppet does all the rest of the work. And that way, the great thing about this is that you know the machine built 6 months ago has all the changes that you've made to your configurations, and so it'll be exactly the same configuration as a machine built today. If you add a user to your configuration, all of the right machines get that user. If you, you know, update a security package, all the machines get that security package. If you're using images, your question is always, well, which image is that guy running? Do I have to reboot that host? And especially with real hardware, you know, you've got that real issue where you don't really want to reboot your real hardware all that often. The virtual machine,
necessarily,
you know,
want to drive there.
Right, yeah. So the virtual machines, in really simplistic cases, images are great. If you've got a cluster of 1,000 nodes that are exactly the same, who cares, right? You spend as much time as you want tuning that image. You can reboot your whole cluster at night. All the scientists who are using it or whatever, they don't care. They're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And that works great. But if you've got 4 or 5 differentiated images, or worse, images that are not quite the same but are pretty similar, then you've got a real problem on your hands.
And so you can use Puppet to manage not just installation and setup, but continuing maintenance.
Oh, yeah. The idea with Puppet is that you would use it from the day you turn the machine on to the day you turn the machine off. You should never have to log on to that machine other than to consume the services it provides rather than, you know, logging in to administer it. And most importantly, I mean, kind of the key that Puppet and tools it competes against also, but I think, you know, Puppet does it better. But the key feature of Puppet is that you write this application that manages your entire network. You know, you've got this infrastructure application that knows how to provision and maintain all the services in your network. And as you update that application, Puppet brings your network into sync. If you change what it means to be an Apache server, then Puppet changes your Apache servers to meet that definition, or it provides helpful exceptions saying, you know, that package doesn't exist, or, you know, whatever the error is. So you should never have to worry about services being out of sync, or one machine was built one day, another machine was built another day, or Johnny built this computer and Billy built that computer, and therefore they're configured differently. This one application manages all of your services for their entire life cycle.
And keeps them up to date.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about operations for a little bit. I said before that you're very much on record as saying we're still stuck in a 70s, 80s mentality. I very much see how Puppet and other tools like this are leading us away from that. To the other areas besides configuration management, change management, where you see operations needing to update or die?
I think the biggest problem with operations right now is that there's a real disconnect between the people who are doing all the work and providing all the value and the people who are writing the checks. And, you know, I was talking to this with some people, including Tim O'Reilly, earlier this week. You can pick up any sysadmin book off the shelf, and I defy you to find one that talks about metrics, how to provide useful metrics to your bosses, how to provide useful metrics to your executives, indicating the value they're providing. You know, how much have you done to demonstrate that you've reduced the error counts on your network? How much have you done to show sure, an SLA is great. Being able to say, you know, look, we know we've got five nines or whatever. That's nice. But how much have you done to really say, here's what we're doing. Here's what we've done. Every time I've ever provided, I mean, like simple information. I wish this were a joke. I've never joined a company that knew how many computers it had. Never. Let's talk about a really simplistic metric here. So just starting at that metric, and you can provide that to your employers, that's a start. But if you go on from there to much better metrics, like what kinds of things we're doing, how many trouble tickets we respond to, how many changes we make, were the changes successful, what was the root cause of all the failures we're having. As you get that information, then you begin really validating your presence.
Sorry about that. Somehow my phone dropped off. You just said, I wish this were a joke, but I've never joined a company that could tell me how many computers it has.
Right. So that's a really simplistic metric, but there are other really great metrics you can provide. You know, obviously, there are all the changes you're making, why you're making those changes. Are they in response to exceptions? Are they adding new features? Are they customer requests? These are the kind of metrics that executives need to know. They need to know, why are you spending all this time doing this? Where did all this time come from? And I know sysadmins constantly complain about, oh, well, I go to my bosses and I say, I need this and I need that. And they just won't give it to me. And I ask them, well, how did you try to convince them? I said, well, I said it very loudly. And what you need to do is, if you show up with the same graphs that the sales guys show up and that the other organizations show up and say, look, here's data showing what I need, there are very few bosses that are going to turn you down. So one of the things that I couldn't focus on this in the first development of Puppet because it's too much work out of the gate. But one of my big goals in Puppet is to build an ecosystem of tools that allows me to really manage what's happening on the network in a way that I can explain, I can provide a clean interface to, you know, obviously my immediate bosses or, you know, the immediate bosses of the IT organizations, but the high-level executives. Look, we deployed 1,000 servers this week. We deployed 1,000 services. We upgraded this. We did that. Here's an R&D graph of the changes that are going on in the network, and here's where we had this spike of errors because someone forced us to do this quick upgrade that we recommended against. Things like that. That direct feedback loop between the people writing the checks and making the high-level strategic decisions and the people doing the actual work on the ground, that's really missing today. And you look at application organizations, software organizations, and that's a lot of what they've been doing is how can we connect our software development to our business needs? You know, you listen to ThoughtWorks podcasts, you read their books, and it's all about that. What is the business need, and how can we best meet that need and then demonstrate they're meeting that need?
So are we, as operations people, I'm not really an operations person anymore, thank goodness, but are the operations people not doing this because they don't know what's necessary, because it doesn't fit our engineer brain personalities, or because we've never really had the tools, or some combination of the three?
I really think it's some combination of the three, and especially I think there's a feedback loop. You go in and you say, you know, you come to some conclusion, you're convinced it's right, and the first time that you get told, no, that's not right, justify it, you know, there's this kind of, well, I shouldn't have to, you know, it's just obvious. I've convinced you via, you know, strong logic.
Here's my engineer brain. It's obvious. You should trust me.
Right. And there's this real belief in the, I think especially in the engineering community, and especially in the sysadmin community, that you shouldn't need to sell something. I shouldn't need to go convince you via anything other than argumentative logic. And to some extent that's true, but data isn't necessarily sales. Using good graphs, using good information, using good research to demonstrate your argument isn't really sales. But even if it is sales, internal sales is probably the most important thing sysadmins can do. I'm not that good at it. But if you do a really good job of selling the value of your organization to the leaders in your organization, you'll be more successful than any tools you can write. I'd love to tell you differently, but if you sell well internally, you'll get access to buy whatever tools you want. If you don't sell well internally, then you're going to be starved for resources. You're going to be constantly fighting with your users instead of enabling them. And the truth is, if you're a sysadmin, if you're not there for your users, why are you there? If you're not there for the organization, for the business needs, why are you there? You know, and I know it's great to build all these great computers, but they're not hiring you to have fun with their computers. They're hiring you to solve their business needs.
Do you agree with the assertion then that IT is just a sunk cost and it doesn't really matter?
Oh, no, not at all. If that were the case, then you couldn't differentiate on IT. And, you know, clearly organizations like Google and Amazon, you know, Amazon especially is a great example, right? They're not a sunk cost. You know, they invested all this money in IT, and not only did they save tons of money in their organization, they've got a fabulous organization operationally, but their organization is so fabulous, they were able to start selling it to other people. I mean, there's no way, if they had viewed their IT as a cost, then they would have stopped investing in it when it was sufficient. And there's no way to have EC2. And who's talking about Amazon? Why is everyone talking about Amazon now? It's certainly not their storefront, right? It's their EC2, it's their S3. That's where all their press is coming from these days. They basically brought the cloud to the forefront, and it was because they had the vision to not view IT as its own cost.
Right, right.
And Tim likes to talk about operations as a competitive advantage, and that and many other cases, it's a clear-cut example of somebody said, if we do it right, we'll outcompete just based on, on not just, it's not a question of reducing costs, right? It's not just a question of how cheap can I make IT, but how much can I make IT work for me? How much can I make my services deploy faster with fewer exceptions, requiring less human input, and, my faster ability to respond to issues? If you've got all those things, you invest in that, then when things do need to scale, then you're ready.
So why don't people see this now? Is it, again, the lack of salesmanship, or no one's really asked that question before, or everyone really tries to put their operations in a corner and says, okay, we hope that we'll be able to compete on this, but we're going to keep it a secret now what we're doing, like all the quants on Wall Street?
I really think it's just it's an uninteresting, unsexy space, and people don't want to talk about it. I've been trying to convince investors and developers and anyone who will listen, let me talk to them for 5 minutes, that this is an interesting problem and that it's worth spending time on. And I basically get crickets. I mean, I was at the Web 2.0 conference in 2005, mostly mm-hmm. to try to learn how I could steal some of their neat ideas and reuse them in system infrastructure. And, I told them what they did, and they were like, wait, what kind of consumer web application is this? And you go, no, it's the stuff that makes web applications work. And they go, that's just unnecessary. it's not sexy. It's not in the front, so they're not interested. But because they're not interested, it's harder to sell to them. Because it's harder to sell to them, the sysadmins feel like they shouldn't have to sell. Because the sysadmins don't try very hard to sell, what they're doing is uninteresting, because the executives go, well, that's not a very interesting sales pitch, and so they're uninterested.
It's a solved problem. They have their shell script to make files, and they're happy.
Right. So, and it certainly, there's an expense there, too. Everyone who I talk about Puppet to, especially anyone in executive who's an executive or who's in sales, says, great, so I can install Puppet and then fire a bunch of people. And you go, no. What happens if you install Puppet is that your service, the service your IT organization provides you, gets 10 times as good. And what 10 times as good means is they can actually start selling to you. Because if you look what it takes for a sysadmin in a new organization to implement the tools it takes to do a good job of demonstrating the value of IT, it's a ton of work. It's a ton of integration. And it's often, today, it's a ton of development. So how do you get the resources to do all that work, to do all that development? Well, you have to do sales. Well, how do you sell that to your organization without any data? It's really hard. So you have these kind of nasty feedback loops where it's up to some person internally. Usually the only way to get out of this loop is to have at least one really kick-ass sysadmin to just say, you know what? I'm not going to do what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to do what I know I should do, but I'm going to focus on sales. I'm going to focus on convincing my organization that this is awesome. And then you need somebody in the managerial chain that says, I see the value in that. I understand the logic of the sale you're trying to make, and I'm going to give you the time and space that you need to get it done. And as long as that time and space is, a year or 6 months, then that's reasonable. They're not going to give you 5 years, but, I think the best example of this I know of is Zev Gitler at Morgan Stanley in the 90s built this tool called, I believe it's called Aurora. And it's not a tool, it's an infrastructure. It was published in the Proceedings of Lisa in, I think, 96, and they're still using it to this day. They haven't really changed it much. And somehow he got the right internally to just rebuild their entire infrastructure based on this great design. And as a result, they've had a completely automated infrastructure for 10 years. And I think they're the only bank that has this across-the-board automated infrastructure. And I talk to the banks, and they go, God, that would be awesome. And they had so much success with that now, they're looking to replace it. They're trying to build a new version of this to last the next 10 years. And there's no discussion internally. Everyone knows this is how you want to do it. No one talks about bringing in big commercial companies to solve the problems because they've had so much success at building this like they've done it before that the sales job is much easier because they've had so much success. Once you get that first bite of success, then the rest of your sales become a lot easier.
Excellent. Well, I just have one last question for you. This has been great. After we get this part solved, selling IT, selling operations to people with checkbooks, what's the next step for system administration, for operations, for integration and configuration? What happens then? What's the next problem to solve, maybe?
I think that the next problem to solve is making things actually more manageable. I think every sysadmin can sympathize with being given a new tool to manage and trying to figure out, how can I automate this thing? You know, every Oracle person will tell you, oh, you cannot automatically install Oracle, or you can only do it with these certain circumstances. And you just learn, you know, I'm not going to listen to you, and I'm going to try to find my own way to automate this tool, right? And Oracle has these, you know, I don't remember what they call them now, but they have something that they claim can do automatic installs, but it only works in these certain circumstances. Every tool has this problem. Every new application introduces this new kind of complexity. So as we get better tools, as we get more sophisticated ecosystems of tools so that instead of your monitoring system being a silo and your configuration management system being a silo, where they start to communicate and you start to get not autonomous systems, but you start to be able to say, okay, Puppet upgraded SSH last night and SSH is broken on all my machines. I wonder if there's a relationship there. You know, so having that kind of work being done automatically, once you have that, then you want to have tools that provide better management interfaces in the first place. I was just talking to a pretty big software company this week. They're the first vendor to ever call me and say, how can I make my software more manageable? And this has been a dream of mine. I want every vendor to ask themselves this question. How can I make my software more manageable? How can I make it easier to plug my software into an integrated management system? And that's really, as you get a completely automated system, as you get the ability to manage more of your network and more of your infrastructure, what you'll find is, partially you're going to always choose your software based on what it does for you, right? But you're also going to be choosing your software based on how manageable it is. And once you can start choosing between two essentially equivalent pieces of software in a relatively commoditized space, but one of them is easily manageable and plugs right into your infrastructure, or possibly even ships the Puppet code to manage that piece of software, and one of them does not. One of them is just like, well, you got a tarball, and you got to put the tarball in this place because it was written by DJB, and he's really insistent. You know, when you have those choices, it becomes an easy choice. So
right.
At that point, you should need fewer people on the ground doing the nuts and bolts like infrastructure kind of development that says, here's how you manage this software, and here's how you manage that software. And then it really becomes a question of how pieces of software relate, how you plug them together, and it looks a lot more like a jigsaw puzzle rather than, you know, a needle and thread kind of sewn together mummy like it is right now.
Or here's a pile of wood, here's your jigsaw, go ahead and build your own puzzle.
Right, exactly. So, and I think when that happens, I think you'll naturally see a split in sysadmins between the people who will swap out hard drives and are kind of really, really on the ground, nuts and bolts, and the people who are much higher level and tend to be, you know, right now they're the infrastructure architects and the infrastructure developers, but in the future will be all about integrating these pieces of software rather than trying to reverse engineer how to manage them, like most of us.
And every company is reverse engineering those right now. Hopefully we won't have to in 5 years.
That would be the hope, wouldn't it?
I don't ever want to do that again myself, personally.
No, and I keep listening to sysadmins talking about it on the Puppet channel and just go, oh, so glad I'm not doing that anymore.
Exactly.
So if you're a sysadmin listening to this, that's one of the ways out. Write your own automation software to allow other people to solve that problem, and they will hopefully give you enough of a living that you don't have to solve it yourself anymore.
And 5 years later, we'll interview you.
Exactly.
Yeah, so great future for that. Well, Luke, I really appreciate your time. This has been fascinating, and I believe and hope it's useful to our readers and listeners.
I hope so, too.
So, again, this is Luke Kniess. Did I pronounce that right, Kniess?
You did, and I'm thoroughly impressed.
I do my research. This is Luke Kniess, who instigated Puppet several years ago. I remember when you started. It was actually great. I was trying to get you to write about CF Engine.
And I refused.
Do something else instead.
Yep. Yeah, it's been a great time.
That was a wise choice.
Great. Well, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you, Luke. Take care.
All right.